from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, inspiring stories of women from all over the world who are bringing light to worlds of darkness. We'll be joined by photojournalist Paola Gianturco, who put together a new book called Women Who Light the Dark, which tells of women using imagination or innovation in the face of rank evil, violence, inequality, poverty, disease, and malnutrition. And we'll meet a number of the remarkable women profiled in the book after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. 129 women in 15 countries on five continents describe their lives, work, and dreams in photojournalist Paola Gianturco's new book, Women Who Light the Dark. Women in Morocco who create and produce plays that educate about women's rights. Girls in Zimbabwe who write and perform poetry that shocks communities into fighting child rape. Vietnamese counselors who heal survivors of domestic violence with line dancing, art, and games. And also women in Nepal teaching other women to drive taxis and lead treks in the Himalayas. Or women teaching women in Nicaragua to become welders, carpenters, and electricians. In Kenya, mothers getting wells dug so their daughters can go to school instead of walking hours just to fetch water. We get these kinds of portraits in Paola's new book, and the book actually sparked us to find women doing work of the sort that are profiled in the book. And in this hour, we're going to turn light on Women Who Light the Dark. And with us, Paola Gianturco, who is independent photojournalist and the author of Women Who Light the Dark, a book which, by the way, is having all of its profits essentially going to the Global Fund for Women. And welcome. Good to have you back here on Forum.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And we're going to be talking, as I said, with a number of the women in the book. But first, we're going to talk with Paola. And I guess a good place to begin with you is there's such a range here. I mean, it's staggering, just the number of people that you talked to and did this research on. And I seem to see two categories, one in the creative arts, women using their imagination. They overlap, of course. But the other really, you know, practical kind of jobs, like being a trek guide in the Himalayas or teaching taxi cab driving. It did kind of boil down to those two pretty much, didn't it?
I saw it a little bit differently. It seemed to me that there was imagination being exercised in the solution that these women were bringing to very serious problems across the board. Many of the groups were using creative arts, but the others were inevitably using creative strategies. And as you say, to invent the idea that women could do jobs that were culturally considered to be inappropriate seemed to me to be creative thinking, just as the use of creative
creativity and imagination are the keys here.
Exactly. You know, many of these women have very little by way of material resources, but they distinguish themselves by having an even more precious resource, and that is imagination. And they apply it in all kinds of ways very, very effectively.
Now, let's talk about that effect. But before we do, you know, I noted that you had done, I mean, you've done photography just about everywhere on the globe, or every region of the globe, every continent, certainly, and with work in armed violence in Nepal and in Morocco and when it was below freezing in Slovakia. But I noted that you said that the most disturbing and the most difficult photography work that you did was in Cambodia and the Cameroons. I just want to get that kind of into the mix here.
This was, of the four books that I've done, easily the most physically and emotionally demanding because these issues are very, very serious. And I found it profoundly disturbing to be with the women in Cameroon, for example, who are working against the AIDS epidemic, seemingly against all odds, and yet they have found a way to train a million people to understand HIV/AIDS, and so they have seen a drop in the level of infection in the Northwest Province in Cameroon, where there had been the highest prevalence of AIDS in the country. And similarly, it was very disturbing to sit and interview the women who had been sex trafficked, who now live and work as prostitutes in Phnom Penh. Their stories are stories of violence and forced sex, and I found that very disturbing. These are difficult, difficult issues.
Well, there are also many disturbing stories in here, but there's that positive sense, again, of creativity and imagination and the way that it's ameliorating, to some extent, the kinds of problems that we're talking about or bringing light, as you say. I mentioned in the last hour, I think, Betty McConey, the woman who works with these child victims of rape. It's a child network, in fact, in Zimbabwe. Half of the young women have been raped, and poetry. And someone would say on the face of it, you know, how is poetry going to help these victims? But it does.
Betty McConey was a high school English teacher, and when she was in her late 20s, she began hearing from her students that they had been raped. That happened because in Southern Africa, I have also heard this rumor in Asia, that men who are HIV positive, if they rape, actually have sex with virgins, they will be cured. So it's a pernicious rumor, obviously untrue, but it causes a great deal of trouble for little girls, some of them as young as even a day old. Betty's organization, which is called the Girl Child Network, she and six high school English students founded this organization together, now encompasses some 20,000 little girls in Zimbabwe. Half, she estimates, have been raped. They're all between the ages of 6 and 16, and they have launched a national movement against child rape in Zimbabwe. It's an astonishment to see how effective they are being, because, as you say, they are using poetry as their weapon. The Shona culture uses poetry. There is a pattern of people who write poems about their experiences and then recite them in public, and these little girls do exactly that. I watch them in community meetings reciting poems about their experiences having been raped, and the communities are outraged and mobilized immediately into action. There is no one who rapes a little girl who escapes their attention. They report people immediately to the police, even when they are very prominent. And somehow they have been able to gain support from business people and academics and politicians and people in government, from men and boys, as well as girls
and women.
It's really
a grassroots movement, I mean, yes. And an effective one. And speaking of that, let's go over to the other side of the globe and talk about dance in Cuba, which you observed.
I visited a wonderful school called the Centro Pro Danza in Havana, which was started by a woman named Laura Alonso, the daughter of the prima ballerina Alicia Alonso. As you may know, ballet is as popular in Cuba as baseball and the Buena Vista Social Club. Every little girl whom I interviewed wanted to be a ballerina when she grew up, but having access to that kind of training would be, you might think, inaccessible. Laura's school makes it accessible. Some thousand little girls study ballet there every day in three shifts. They pay less than a dollar, and so they have access to their dreams.
Talking again with Paula Junguro, and the book that she produced is called Women Who Light the Dark. There are also women who imaginatively, as we've said, like in Nicaragua, a woman named Amanda Centeno, whose family, actually her brothers were killed by Somoza's troops, and she was kidnapped and tortured, and now she's training women to be electricians, welders, and carpenters. In Kathmandu, women training women to be taxi drivers and entrepreneurs in the sort of Muhammad Yunus style. In Nepal, Himalaya trekking guides. I mean, there's just a whole range, again, of both practical and creative and imaginative ways of dealing with, well, what could easily be seen as despair. And what we did was we brought together some women who are also working along these lines, and we wanted to hear from a number of them. One of them, who is profiled in Paula's book, is Susan Segal, who is CEO and co-founder of Mobility International USA, MIUSA, which is, and she is a recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship. She's with us from Eugene, Oregon, and We'll say good morning to Susan Segal.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, actually, Susan Segal, like the bird. But
Segal,
good morning.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, and thank you for this invitation, and hello to Paola.
Hi, Susan.
We're glad to have you here, and you've been working essentially with the disabled. You yourself are disabled, we should mention. In fact, we're given an award, the Disabled Oregonian of the Year, during President Clinton's administration, and we're talking about really getting disabled women out there doing things and getting them mobile in the sense of recreation and activity. And, I mean, that's what you're about, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. One of the fabulous things about Paola's book is so many times we hear about women working on human rights issues around the world, but this book is such a gift because it profiles many of our 30 disabled women from around the world who are all disability activists who are working on discrimination issues of disabled women. And really, around the world, disabled women are taking leadership and trying to solve their own problems. And what we do every year is bring 30 disabled women who are blind, who are deaf, who speak many, many different languages, sign language, Spanish, Russian, whatever, and bring them together and form a family of women with disabilities. So basically we can share strategies and how women with disabilities ourselves can make changes. And that is an amazing positive feeling to be surrounded by that kind of energy.
I'm sure it gives you a feeling of power and collectivity. And we also should mention that women with disabilities are, and public may not know this, more vulnerable to violence, especially from their own family members and from caregivers.
Right. The statistics, you know, are unfortunately, you know, terrible for all women. But women with disabilities, again, sometimes are faced with double discrimination. They have a higher sense of, there's a higher incidence of violence against disabled women. They have less chance of getting health care, more chance of getting sexual abuse. And so we would do things like self-defense, where women with disabilities can learn how to defend themselves. They can learn about, as Paola mentioned, health and HIV issues, so the disabled women can have the knowledge and the power and to go back to their communities and train other disabled women.
So you're also concerned not only about discrimination and trying to work together as a group against discrimination, but also there are issues having to do with reproductive rights, forced sterilization, for example.
Right. I mean, basically, you know, the women with disabilities are saying they want to have the same rights as women everywhere. And besides just working on some of the very difficult issues, that we also make sure that we use the time to do some things, as sort of Paola mentioned, they use creativity and imagination. Like, we have women doing the challenge courses where they go up 40 feet in the air and they go river rafting. So what we're trying to do is take women who are coming from very, very difficult situations, working on impossible issues, give them the skills, give them the strategies, but also give them the sense of positiveness, the strength, and not to let other people's preconceived notions decide what they are able to do.
Susan Segal, again, is CEO and co-founder of Mobility International USA and a recipient of MacArthur Fellowship. She's with us from Eugene. Namalka Fernando is an attorney at law and president of IMADAR, the International Movement Against All Forms of Discrimination and Racism. And she's with us from Colombo, in Sri Lanka. And there's every likelihood, Ms. Fernando, that this call is being monitored and listened to in Sri Lanka?
Yeah, I think so. Since recently I realized that my telephone has this funny sound of being tapped. But come what may, I participate in this discussion, and that's part and parcel of the intense militarization and the manner in which the establishment keep a tab on human rights activists.
Well, your organization started in Japan, an international movement, again, against all forms of discrimination and racism, founded in 1988, by the Baruco people of Japan, one of the largest minorities. And Sri Lanka has a high literacy rate, but there's much discrimination, and there's concern that you're fighting this discrimination from the government's point of view against their wishes?
The issue here is that in Sri Lanka we've had this war for the last 25 years, which is called the ethnic conflict with the Tamil community in Sri Lanka. So the intense militarization that the minority community has experienced in their struggle to be recognized within the governing process, the issue of need for devolution of power, so on and so forth, have intensified the military conflict. And apart from that, the minority communities in Sri Lanka have faced discrimination with regard to use of their language for a long, long period, which finally ended up in this conflict. Even though the law is there now for use of the language, it's not implemented. You know, this I know within this short period of time, I will not be able to explain to you the historical and the political context of the struggle, but the minorities have experienced discrimination in the in their day-to-day life experience in Sri Lanka as a community. Of course, individuals, one could always reply of the Sri Lankan state is, of course, there are individuals who have achieved. In any society, individuals who have struggled will achieve. But when you look at the individual and the experience of the large community, then we are talking about two experiences.
So this is what you're essentially fighting against as a group of women.
Yeah, presently the issue of minority women and their experiences in the conflict of Sri Lanka is grave. I've just returned from a visit to a district of Manna, where there is high level of conflict being experienced today. And there are almost like half the IDPs in the internally displaced camps are women and children. And some of these women have only one garment, one piece of clothes to wear for the last 25 days, because they were immediately evacuated by the government forces, saying that this area is to be should come under government control. So they were all pushed back into IDP camps, and the women just ran away for safety with whatever they could carry, and they would not carry clothes. They would just carry few items, but there are women who just, because they were looking after the welfare of their children, because they had to quickly run away, carrying few things and carrying their children. You know, the one of the major engagement for us now is to provide clothes for women. You know, this is a pattern. After tsunami, in conflict, when we meet women, you know, the women's experiences seem to be of this deprivation and of this...
We're just talking about practical things in the face of war, about finding clothes to put on people's backs. And again, Malcolm Fernando is attorney at law and president of IMADAR, the International Movement Against All Forms of Discrimination and Racism, with us from Colombo, Sri Lanka. With us also this morning is Christine Schuler Deschriver, and she's a human rights activist with Haifu Fur Congo Kivu. That's HHK. They're a Swiss human rights organization, and she is an NGO. And I should mention that her mother is Congolese, and her life has been a kind of struggle. Her mother's life certainly was a struggle against racism. Her mother was a victim. She herself saw a close friend of hers raped and killed by mercenaries. This is... pretty horrific stuff, women being forced to eat their own children and babies raped and mutilated and things that are just unspeakable. And welcome, Christine Deschriver. Glad to have you.
Good afternoon, everybody. I hope you can hear me.
We can hear you fine, and just interested in hearing about the work that you're doing now, because the death roll, according to the World OMF, is probably the highest in the Congo than anywhere, and I know you've done work even with Eve Ensler and others to try to ameliorate these problems. What is your group doing now?
Right now, first of all, I'm very honored to participate in this debate and talking about what's going on now in Congo the last 10 years, because we are talking about one of the worst humanitarian disasters of the century, and we don't know why the world becomes so deaf in spite of all the problems we do have here. Until now, we have more than 4 million people who already died in Democratic Republic of Congo, and only in my province, more than 100,000 women and children were raped. And I'm sure it's even much more than that. So we are talking, like Mrs. Elster wrote in her article, we are talking about a femicide here in the province of South Kivu.
And your organization, not only in getting the word out like you're doing now, but is doing what specifically to combat
this?
I have to
say, I'm working for the German Technical Cooperation, but, you know, avoiding all the heavy administration of the international institution, we decided with some friends in Switzerland to create an NGO. It's the Hilfe für Kongo Kivu, to try to find some money to help, to quick help people. For example, like these very, very young mothers. I'm talking about from 12 years old mothers raped with babies. We need to have urgent money and money available to put them to the hospital to make this operation, because they are too young, they cannot have the babies normally, to put them after back to school, to try to find a roof for them. That's the reason we decided to create with some friends this NGO to have quick help. And also, we are working, this German Technical Cooperation, with also with UNICEF, we are working to identify and register the victims. And after, also to try to find some help, psychological help, and also reintegration in the society. And we are also working a lot against discrimination in the society.
Christine Schuller de Shriver, again, is a human rights activist and a Swiss human rights NGO, and we're going to break shortly, but we'll hear from some more women in the course of this hour, and, of course, from you, our listeners. In fact, if you'd like to join this conversation, I would invite you to do so now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You may want to talk to some of the women who are with us this morning, or you may want to cite some examples of your own about women lighting and providing imaginative or creative answers and ways of responding to what is in many cases appropriately called the darkness out there. Paula Gianturco, before we go to break, some thoughts from you about what you've heard here from some of these other women who are not profiled in your book.
First of all, I want to thank them for the work they're doing. I was inspired to work on this project because in 40 countries where I was documenting women's lives, everywhere I saw projects where women were working this way. And I wanted also to say that I would be honored to include their projects on the project website, which is www.womenwholightthedark.com, because surely Maka and Christine are among the women who, along with Susan Siegel, belong in this category.
And again, we welcome your phone calls. You can join us toll-free, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, at 866-733-6786, or send an email to us, and our email address is forum@kqed.org. We're going to talk also later on in the hour with the executive chair of the board of directors of the Intertribal Friendship House, working with Native American women, and also with Aisha Claddy, the founder of the Attitudinal Healing Connection. This is Forum, and again, our guest is the author of the book Women Who Light the Dark. It's Paula Gianturco, and she's an independent photojournalist. You're listening to Forum on KQED Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with women who are involved in really changing the communities that they're in and bringing light to those communities, often in many respects facing problems of domestic violence, war and poverty and illiteracy and sexual trafficking and discrimination of all kinds, as well as malnutrition and disease and poverty of all kinds. And Paula Gianturco has really profiled a whole array of women globally. She's an independent photojournalist. In her book, Women Who Light the Dark, we talk with Susan Siegel, who is one of those who was profiled in Paula's book. And with others, women that we found that we thought would be important for you, our listeners, to hear from this hour, Namalka Fernando from Sri Lanka and Christine Schuler de Shriver from the Congo. I also want to talk with you, our listeners, but before we get to our calls, Morningstar Ghali is joining us. She's executive chair of the board of directors of the Intertribal Friendship House and co-chairs Advocates to Protect Secret Sites, a student at Mills College, majoring in anthropology, sociology, and ethnic studies there, and she's with us locally from Oakland. And let me say good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Should also mention that you were raised in the Bay Area Indian community and were born in a American Indian Movement basement. And in many ways, being an activist in the American Indian Movement as a woman is, well, a rare thing to some extent. I mean, you're kind of being a pathfinder here.
In some ways it is, and I just want to acknowledge also that today is Indigenous Peoples Day, and so it is not Columbus Day, and so I want to give a warm Indigenous Peoples Day greeting to everyone out there. We're just returning right now from the Alcatraz ceremony that we had this morning in honoring our ancestors and our relatives, and then honoring our women over there, because as we recognize, our women are the backbone of our nation.
Yeah, the women, as I say, have been gaining a voice in the Native American movements of all sorts, because it has been a male-dominated movement. Your concerns are with not only sacred sites, but with reproductive justice. And there was a cover story, in fact, in today's San Francisco Chronicle about Clover Valley. Do you know about that whole battle over there, development and sacred sites?
I did see that story in the Chronicle, and I just want to mention that it is an ongoing battle, and it is an intentional battle for our right to pray, for our places to go gather medicine that we were taught as a young girl. These were places that I've been taken to go gather medicine, to go pray at, and so now we, you know, the work that I do in helping to bring education and awareness to protecting these sacred sites is an inherent responsibility. Within this last year, there were three cases that went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals right here in San Francisco, and that was with Cave Rock, the San Francisco Peaks and Medicine Lake. And in all three cases, the original verdict was overturned, and so it was victory rulings for the tribes on all three cases. And so it isn't, you know, just a few battles of many to be won, but you know, we're definitely setting a precedent there with that.
And what about the fight with reproductive justice and with sterilizations that have occurred? Where are you and what are you doing on that front?
Well, I was involved with some of the Sister Song national membership meetings, and that is just a really important issue to create awareness about, that over 75% of Native women were sterilized back, you know, even as late as the 1970s and 80s out on the reservations, and they were going into the Indian Health Service hospitals, and it was forced sterilization, or was also, you know, unauthorized at many times, that the women didn't even know that they were being sterilized. And so, and it's, you know, it's a continuing legacy of genocide that's been perpetrated against our people, and so that is still happening today in our clinics.
Morningstar Ghali, again with us from Oakland, is executive chair of the board of directors of the Intertribal Friendship House and co-chairs the Advocates to Protect Secret Sites. And Aisha Claudi is founder of the Attitudinal Healing Connection. She's also with us from Oakland this morning, and author of Beyond Fear, 12 Spiritual Keys to Racial Healing. Good morning to you.
Good morning. It's a joy to be with you all this morning. It's a joy to see what women are doing.
Well, let's find out what you're doing. This actually, some of your roots go back to Jerry Jampolsky, I believe, don't they?
Yes. I worked very closely with Jerry Jampolsky. He founded the Center for Attitudinal Healing in Tiburon, and our work is focused. We define racism as a life-threatening illness that is impacting and killing all of us. And our focus is really to help young people begin to tap into their creative abilities so that they can begin to, to succeed in our culture. Most people in a first world country, what's happening with our young people is we imprison more young people than any first world country in the world. And also racism is definitely something that we, as human beings, we must begin to ameliorate.
Well, you mentioned racism as an illness. I remember in the autobiography of Malcolm X, he talks about how it would be a great idea to set up clinics to deal with racism. And that's all about changing attitudes. What specifically are you doing to change attitudes or to diminish the illness?
Well, one of the things we do, we've done for 14 years, we hold a racial healing circle, and we use creative process where we all come together in the community to drum. And after drumming, we do dialogue and deal with our race issues. Another very important thing...
Wait, excuse me. Let me back you up for a moment. Do you get kind of a members of the choir for something like that?
Anyone can come.
But are people who really have problems with racism likely to come to something like
not
that?
Not members of the choir, but anyone. So it's mixed groups, mixed race groups, people from all over the country and all over the world drop in because this is a group, this is on the Internet. And it's,
but forgive me, Aisha, you're talking about people who care about this and want to change their attitudes, usually have very positive attitude about wanting to change their attitudes. What about those people who do not fit into that category?
That's why we drum, because some people come who don't fit in that category. And we drum as a way to get people to on the same page. Because when we first started, it was a lot of us and them and fighting and people not wanting to be together. Like whites wanted to talk about race among themselves. Blacks wanted to talk about race among themselves. And we wanted to bring people together to talk about this issue.
And the drumming brings them, huh?
Yeah, and the drumming brings them together. Because, you know, the American Anthropological Association says the concept of race is a human construction. Race is, just doesn't exist among human species. So as an intelligent people, why do we still categorize ourselves as racist?
Aisha Cloete, again from Oakland, is the author of Beyond Fear and also the founder of the Attitudinal Healing Connection. And let's get our callers involved in this. Again, some of you may want to talk to our guests individually or to Paula Gianquirico or just put on the record here somebody who you feel fits this category of women who we are finding are lighting in imaginative and innovative ways some of the darkness that surrounds us. Your call's welcome, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can email us. Our email address here is forum@kqed.org, and without any tarrying, let's go to Brendan. Morning, Brendan.
Good morning. It's a real privilege to be on the show, and I'll mention that within the last few weeks, I actually made the decision and to become a donor to KQED for the first time in my life, and it was a darn good feeling.
Good of you to do that. Thank you.
Yeah. So I was moved to call mainly about the Sudan and Darfur. As I was listening to your description and your guest's description of these ongoing atrocities, I became quite emotional listening in my car. I was almost afraid that I might get choked up driving down the road. And the feeling and thought that I keep having about this is it is to our shame. And shame is really the word I want to use. I'm ashamed of my own nation and of the civilized world that we are letting these atrocities continue. It's wonderful that your guest is doing these things with this NGO to light the darkness as much as she can, and I know that hers isn't the only organization that's tried to help the survivors of these atrocities somehow pick up the pieces of their existences, but that has a quality of you know, sort of trying to plug up the holes in a very leaky boat. And I think it's to our shame that we don't have some, you know, I hate to use a term like peacekeeping forces because it sounds so propaganda-ish, but why don't we have soldiers on the ground setting limits for the people that commit these atrocities? The Janjaweed cannot be anywhere near as well equipped as the insurgents in Iraq, and it would represent such a small investment.
Brendan, we're in the interest of time, I'm going to extend my thanks to you for calling and move to other callers who want to get involved in this, but I thank you for your comments, and the comments certainly bear on both hours that we've done this morning, because we did devote the last hour to ongoing crisis in Darfur. This hour, much more geared into and focused on women who are doing work in the face of other crises and really bringing, as we said, light into the darkness. Let's go to more of your calls. And Wanda joining us from Oakland. Morning.
Good morning. I've spoken of this once before to you, Michael, but I'd just like to remind everyone listening and also get comments from each of the speakers. about how everything starts with a small beginning. My mother and some other women started making sack lunches in the basement of a church, and from that sprung the UFO, United Food Organization in Santa Clara County, and the Senior Citizens Movement. So each of these women started at some point, and each of us can do the same, some small movement that got them where they are today, and I'd like them to speak on that.
Well, we'll hear from them. I'm just reminded, recently I did an onstage interview with Wangari Maathai, the 2004 Nobel laureate, who started the Greenbelt Movement, and she tells this wonderful story out of Japan about a hummingbird. The forest is on fire, the jungle is on fire, and the hummingbird is taking a little water and going back and forth, back and forth. They say, what are you doing? This is a conflagration beyond control. Your little water. I'm doing all that I can. And that's kind of the message that maybe is coming across here. Susan Siegel, let's go to you first on this. What got you started? And
right. Well, actually, I went to school in the Bay Area. I graduated from Berkeley, and I got together with some other women with disabilities in the Bay Area, and we, after having a short conversation, realized that we really needed to change the paradigm of disabled women instead of being quiet and passive and, oh, isn't that too bad, that we were very powerful women and needed to change how we perceive ourselves in order to change the world. And many of the women involved in that small group have gone on to be leaders in the disability rights movement. And, you know, as a woman with a disability, from that small beginning and saying, hey, you know, I'm loud, I'm proud, I'm passionate, how do I go and help organize disabled women around the world who also then can reach out to their own communities? So, yes, I agree. It's got to start with a small step, and it's got to start with your own awakening of the power that each of us have.
You want to add to that, Ayesha Clote? You talked about the infamous.
Yes, I do, because we started out of the racial healing circle, women came together to begin to support children. And so we started working with a small group of children, Amana Harris, who's the director of Artesteem. And Artesteem is a program that's bringing art back into school. 7 kids on a Saturday. And now we're serving 3,000 children a month in Oakland Unified School Districts.
That's great. Good morning, Sarah Gully.
Yeah, definitely. There was, for myself with the sacred sites, it was a couple of years ago when the Shell Mound Peace Walk started, and just going around the Bay Area and seeing all the shell mounds that had been desecrated and bulldozed over, and knowing that there's so many other sacred sites that, you know, that's not what we wanted. We wanted these places to still be intact, to take our children, to take our children's children just as we had been taken to when we were younger. And with the Friendship House also, I mean, that was a place that I've been going to since I was a baby. And so I'm growing up there, and in our Save the Legacy campaign, you know, we put everything that we had into it, and just knowing that, you know, that we wanted to keep the doors open for the generations to come, and just as our elders and our ancestors have done in paving the way for us, that we needed to be able to provide that door open for our children as well.
And from Oregon and Oakland, we go to Sri Lanka. Nimalka Fernando, let's get you on
record
here.
Yeah, I've been listening to very powerful stories from all the women. Thank you very much for the sharing. My own engagement comes from the fact that from our student days, I studied in a Christian college, and then we were very much moved by the poverty surrounding us, and also I myself belong to a working class family. So there was this feeling that you are not respected, or you become marginalized in a social order. So I think it's partly my own experience of being marginalized, my own experience of being discriminated, that made me really search for movements, search for organizations that work against racism, and that work to eliminate discrimination and to address issues of elimination, be it caste, ethnicity, or religious. So I think for me it's very personal, partly because I faced it, and I know what it means to be looked down upon. So I think from that beginning, then I joined the various movements, and I think the women's groups in Sri Lanka, searching for peace in this country, Sri Lanka, was my I should say, which gave me life
It was a catalyst, really. Yes.
Yeah, and also to find for alternatives, to say no to war, and to also to get women who are polarized already as a result of the ethnic conflict, the Tamil women, the Muslim women, and the Sinhala women together to create a new country is like our lifelong vision and the battle. So I think a lot of women have taught me that, you know, you can't just give up. Suffering is comes out of the militarized situation, but at the same time we have to search to find an end to this war, because finally we have to give a world without war to our children. So I think this comes from every single woman I meet across the communities, and even the women who have faced intense brutality in the hands of whoever who has taken up arms would cry for justice, but at the same time say that we do not want a militarized Sri Lanka anymore.
Again, Namalka Fernando is president of IMADAR, the International Movement Against All Forms of Discrimination and Racism. And Christine Schuller-Deschriver, let's get you into this. Personal for you, certainly, in your beginnings. Do we have Christine Schuller-Deschriver with us? She was on with us before. She's a Swiss human rights NGO. We'll try to reconnect with her. An email here from a listener, Jan, who says, thank you for this program. As I sit in my nice home in the East Bay listening to these horrible stories about what women are going through in other parts of the world, the obvious question is, what can I do? We want to be a part of the solution, many of us. Thanks again for the program. Paula, some thoughts to reflect on that with all these women that you've profiled?
I do have some thoughts. Several of the women we've been listening to and talking with this morning have suggested that they need funding. Inevitably, women's organizations need help with funding. That's one of the reasons that I'm giving 100% of the royalties from my book to the Global Fund for Women. They have now, in the past 20 years, funded some almost $60 million worth of grants that have gone to women's organizations in 164 countries. I also have included on the Shine Your Light portion of www.womenwholightthedark.com lots of ideas about ways that you can be involved. Some of the ideas range from taking a volunteer vacation, and some of the ideas have to do with contributing money. There are, in fact, lots of things you can do.
And I think we have Christine Schuller-Deschriver back on the air with us now, do we? Christine?
Yes,
you're there.
I'm sorry, we were interrupted.
Well, I'm sorry we got interrupted, because I was going to ask you, as I've asked the other participants, about this idea of how you get something small started and what leads you into where you've gone, essentially. I mean, a lot of it was personal for you, as I indicated, wasn't it?
Excuse me, I didn't really hear you. Can you please repeat?
A lot of what got you started in doing what you're doing was personal, when you began doing what you're doing now as an activist.
Yeah, you know, it's personal, because you cannot just stay here in your office doing your work and see all this violence around you. You know, I was like getting tired of buried 10-month babies who were raped, very old women, like 87-year-old women buried. In 2000, when they brought me this 18-month baby with broken legs, because she was so, she was raped in such a violent, I cannot even explain. Then you have two choices. Or you take your suitcase with your children and leave this hell, or you decided to change something. But it's impossible, you know, after 10 years of war, we are not the same persons anymore. We just have two choices. And now we became extreme protector of human rights, because we saw the real value of life. And I would like, and I'm so pleased to talk about this forgotten war, I would like the old world, you know, to wake up and not to hear what's going on in Congo, just to listen, like Mrs. Ensler did by coming here in Bukavu, to listen what's going on, to listen to mothers explaining that the meat they were eating, when they were taken as slave sex, that the meat they were eating were their own children. So we have to talk about the problem that's going on here in Congo. It's a femicide, it's a Holocaust, far away from the whole world. We have these UN peacekeepers in Congo. Of course, they are not enough. And for me, they are just more here in this country as observers than doing action. Everybody knows who is doing 60% of peace rate. These people who made the genocide in Rwanda, and the whole world seems like they're blind and deaf, not to want to see what's going on in their country. The only thing that interests the people is all gold, uranium, and everything we have, and nobody's talking about this, the suffering of this population.
Well, you're certainly making a graphic here for us, and I thank you for that. Again, Christine Schuler-Deschreiber with us, Swiss Human Rights NGO, who's worked in the Congo. And we have another caller with us. George, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thanks. You do such a great job on the program. I appreciate it. I wonder if I could just address the comment that was very disturbing by your guest with regard to the forced sterilization of the Native Americans from the Native American clinics.
And the question is?
Yeah, the question is, she mentioned she thought that was a governmental genocide, and I'm curious about that because I thought those clinics were controlled by the tribal councils and by the reservations.
Morning, Sargelli.
No, the clinics are actually not controlled by the tribal governments. They are controlled by Indian Health Service, which is overseen by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which has a trust responsibility with Native peoples, where Native peoples are in the category of those that are, it's considered blind, deaf, handicapped, that we were considered wards of the state, and that the government has a trust responsibility over us because we were not seen as people, and that still exists until this day, to where we are not seen as fully capable of being able to control our own affairs. And so you see that in the tribal governments, you see that in the Indian health clinics, you see that all across the tribal government status, and even in our status of our sovereignty as sovereign nations and our relationship with this U.S. government, that sovereignty status is we don't have that fully within the United States, so it's not recognized.
Good morning, Sargelli is executive chair of the board of directors of the Intertribal Friendship House. I thank George for his call. Let me get another caller on, and that's Claire. Good morning. Claire, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, you're on the air.
I keep thinking that the United States is an empire. We talk to the rest of the world on a moral high ground, but we have never passed an equal rights amendment here. The status of women around the world is endangered by the fact that this country cannot acknowledge women's status.
Claire, you seem to be in assent here. Agree with the sentiments? Paula, agree with the sentiments?
I think it is scandalous that the United States has not ratified the Equal Rights Amendment, or CEDA, which is, of course, the United Nations anti-discrimination statement, which began being ratified by countries around the world for almost 40 years ago now, and which we haven't yet ratified either.
We could light a lot of light if we did, huh?
We could.
And let me thank Claire for her call. And Audrey, you're on with us. Welcome to Forum. Good morning.
Yes, thank you. My name is Audrey, and I'm calling from Oakland. And I went out to this little city outside of Modesto called Greeley Valley. And it was a black woman who had two disabled sons. And she suffered from hate crimes, racial epithets were being flung at her. And not only that, the neighbors had guns and was shooting. So we called the sheriff, and they were, like, kind of indifferent. You know, they could shoot their guns or whatever. And so that's just, I think we have racial, we don't have to go to, like, New Orleans to see the Jenna episodes or probably among all of us. And we need to ask Hillary Clinton and Barack and others to take on this issue on a regular basis and programs like yours. We should be having an annual debate about it in the discussion, because when we allow it to remain silent, we imagine that the problems have disappeared when, in fact, They're there, but they just have not been discovered.
I agree with you, Andre. I think it's important to have this ongoing conversation about race, and we take it very seriously on this program, as many who listen to it on a regular basis are quite aware of. Aisha, Claudia, though, I mean, it's not only important a conversation, but important importance here of actions. I mean, he's talking about just day-to-day battles against racism that really ought to involve police and justice.
However, you know, one of the things we have to realize is that unless we as individuals begin to really, really come out of our denial and then do our personal work. And so the day-to-day personal work is very, very, very important. But also conversations. We have a racial healing circle that we hold monthly at our Attitudinal Healing Center. And we also offer race workshops and trainings. And it's so important that we begin to look at this and begin to heal from it. You saw what happened in Jenna. Rather than call a dialogue on racism, they cut the tree down.
Well, on that note, we've actually come to the end of the program. I want to extend thanks to you, Aisha Clode, for joining us from Oakland this morning. Again, she's founder of the Attitudinal Healing Connection and author of Beyond Fear, 12 Spiritual Keys to Racial Healing. Also with us this morning from Oakland was Morningstar Galley, the executive chair of the board of directors of the Intertribal Friendship House and co-chair of the Advocates to Protect Secret Sites, a student at Mills. And I want to thank Christine Schuler-Deschriver, who joined us to talk about the Congo. She's a human rights activist and a Swiss human rights NGO. And Namaka Fernando, who joined us from Sri Lanka, attorney at law and president of IMIDAR, the International Movement Against All Forms of Discrimination and Racism. Our thanks also to Susan Siegel, the CEO and co-founder of Mobility International USA, recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, who joined us from Eugene, Oregon. And Paula Giang Turco, who joined us here in studio, independent photojournalist, and her book again is Women Who Light the Dark. All of the proceeds will go to the Global Fund for Women. And thank you all. And thank you, our listeners. We appreciate your being with us here. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineer is Dave Freeman. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.